This is NetStat.fm, your weekly podcast about networking, Rust, and everything in between. You are listening to episode 37, recorded on April 28, 2026. In this episode, we welcome Jess Eisen and Russell Cohen from Amazon to discuss Dial 9. We talk about how Dial 9 captures runtime, kernel, and application events together, and how this approach helps you better understand what is really happening inside your system, especially when debugging complex problems. Let's begin.
Welcome to another week of NetStat.fm. This week we will talk about Dial 9. It's a very exciting new tool that hooks into the Rust ecosystem and Tokyo in specific. It labels itself as a low overhead runtime telemetry for Tokyo. There's a lot to unpack here. It's a very new tool. There's also a very exciting horizon for it, I bet. But before all that, I want to introduce the guests. They are Jess Eisen and Russell Cohen. Both work at Amazon and they are the creators of Dial 9. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yes, and of course, I hope I pronounced your names correctly. That's always a difficult one.
Perfect.
Okay, that's a good start. So with that said, it's the first time that we meet the both of you. Some in the community might know you already. Still, I would like to get to know a bit the both of you a bit better.
Go for it, Russell.
Sounds good. So my journey to being here kind of started during the pandemic. I was freelancing. And as I was freelancing, I started getting involved in Rust, both the Rust compiler, and also I worked on some semi-popular open source Rust libraries. And freelancing during the pandemic, it got pretty boring. I decided I wanted to find a real job, and I found a job writing the Rust SDK for AWS on Reddit, and kind of the rest is history. I joined to start the Rust SDK, and worked on that for about 4 years until it went 1.0, and then I switched to Amazon has the central Rust team, where our job is really to make Rust builders at Amazon successful, and I switched to really start leading the efforts focused on internal Rust builders at Amazon in about 2024, and I've been there ever since.
And what about you, Jess? How did you get here?
All right, Jess, I use she. So I have a bit of a non-traditional background. I don't have a CS degree. I used to be a bicycle courier, and we needed a online ordering platform to compete with Grubhub. And then in the process of helping to build that, I hopped over to the company that did build it, and then I was a project manager, and then a backend engineer, and bada bing, bada boom. I wound up software engineering. I didn't know Rust when I started working at Amazon. I joined a team that was doing advanced bot control stuff, similar to like when you think about Cloudflare's bot protection, similar problem space. And they were using Rust for a mix of things, both like a pretty high-performance data plane, but also like control plane and things higher up the stack. I loved the language. And then maybe a year ago, I joined Russell's team, working with like Nico and Carl and a bunch of folks in the Rust community. I'm really excited to be able to take things that we were doing internally and figure out how to scale them to make it successful, you know, make them useful for Rust in general. More broadly, it's like something I get a lot of, you know, excitement about in my job. Right now, I'm pretty focused on sort of the telemetry and metrics story in the network services ecosystem, trying to get it so that you get, you know, when you're using a Java network stack, you see packets in, packets out. I want that for Rust. That's me.
Well, very cool. Thank you for that. And did I understand correctly? So this is a team specifically focused on open sourcing software and working on tooling, or what is the context of this team specifically?
Our team is really focused on whatever it takes to make Rust successful at Amazon is sort of in our wheelhouse. So some days that's working on some internal package. Some days that's upstreaming contributions to Cargo or the Rust compiler or Tokyo. And some days that's working on external libraries. We try as much as possible to build software that's open source first. so to that extent, it works on open source stuff, but our ultimate mission is mostly to make Rust successful at Amazon, whatever that needs to be.
Okay. And our position is Rust being successful at Amazon is Rust being successful in general, right? And it's two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, yeah. That's very cool and very exciting. Of course, Amazon started like long ago, and it is not one of those newer companies where Rust was there from the first days. It has gone through a huge journey, and Amazon is investing a lot in Rust. Do you still need to convince people at Amazon that Rust is there for the benefit of them, or what's the story at this point?
Good question. I think we're seeing a lot of new projects choose Rust. Ultimately, today, I think we help people make informed choices about Rust much more than we try to convince people to use Rust. The worst thing that can happen is that some team picks Rust and it's not a good fit, and 1 year later they deeply regret it. So we're really all about giving people the tools they need to make educated choices.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more, because of course it's just a tool. It's one of many great languages, and depending on what you want to produce or what is the context, you might or you might not use Rust, so I can appreciate it very much. Now, something I also think I understood from earlier is that you looked at what are you producing internally, what is working internally, the things you're finding internally, and you want to kind of bring that into the open. Is it also so for Dial 9? Like, was there some predecessor that you were using or some kind of bunch of tools, and Dial 9 is kind of like the evolved version?
I think in some sense, there is no tool that was Dial 9 before, but there's two things internally that led to Dial 9. One is this idea that I see a lot inside of Amazon, but not so much outside, which is that rather than thinking about metrics as the unit of things that you're producing, thinking about producing events and deriving the metrics from the events, which means that when you were trying to debug, you actually had the exact events available. And this is a pattern at Amazon that teams have used to make it much easier to debug complex problems. So that's the first thing, and I'll talk about how that fits into Dial 9. The second one is I had watched people, very skilled engineers, debugging really hard problems, and they had a fluency with deep system tools like changing kernel scheduling settings or running their workload under perf schedule to look at the scheduling trace and back solving what must have been the problem, or running profilers in esoteric probing modes to look for certain problems. And for a lot of Rust problems at Amazon, this seemed to be what it took. And Dial 9 is kind of the combination of two of those ideas, which is, one, if you can record all the events, it's much easier to debug. And two, making it possible for anybody to get access effectively to those data streams that exist and are not that hard to use, but can be quite tricky to get in practice.
I see. And a listener mentioned that also he had a conversation with you, Russell, about Dial 9, where you mentioned that production systems at AWS is highly restricted. Does this constrain, like, shape in any way the tool is built? And let's say you would be allowed to access production systems, what would be unlocked by that you couldn't do now?
Yes. So the things that you can't, like, for example, you cannot simply SSH into a production host at AWS. I think this should be not too surprising. And a lot of those tools, like getting perf event data, you simply can't get without SSHing into the host. If you operate in an environment where you can, I think some of this benefit of Dial 9 is negated, but still, simply being able to get all the data into a trace is quite powerful. I think if you operated in an environment where you had very little restrictions on what was available in production, then you could imagine that we build some modules for Dial 9 that access extremely privileged APIs and run with dangerous levels. I put those are the scare quotes of kernel permissions available beyond what people at AWS use. Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah, yeah, that's perfect. And I can imagine even if you have that access, there are still things you would want to do anyway. So that makes totally sense. Thank you for that. Now, you mentioned around events and you wanted metrics driven. You also mentioned in, well, you didn't mention it here, but like in the README, it talks about, okay, it wants to be low overhead runtime telemetry. So we hear the word telemetry there. You also mentioned the word span. So all of this makes me think a lot about open telemetry. Is that what you are building upon, like using as maybe the transport vehicle or, I don't know, medium or however you call it, or is it just something very closely related?
I think they're closely related. I think there's a world where Dialline and OpenTelemetry eventually sort of fit together. At least at AWS, very few people are using OpenTelemetry, so having a standalone system was pretty important. The way that Dialline data gets out to host in generally is that Dialline will write it to disk and then a background thread will upload it to S3. So separately from, it's not using an OpenTelemetry collector or anything like that. It more borrows concepts, I would say. And we're talking about the Dialline trace format itself. I think it will become sort of relevant why it is its own format and not an OpenTelemetry specific format. But there's absolutely a lot of overlaps. Okay. Personally, I'm not a deep OTel expert, but.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think very few of us are, even though we might admire it. Now, in Tokyo, there's also the tracing ecosystem. And, for example, it is compatible with OpenTelemetry, but it's not specific to OpenTelemetry. It also is used, I believe, within Tokyo itself and adding a lot of events, logs, and all these things. Is that something you also then make use of within Dial9 as a source of information, or is that not yet the thing?
Yeah, I recently added a tracing layer. We have the ability to emit custom events inside the trace, which is really nice because then you have a single place to go and correlate, you know, a given request ID with the behavior on the runtime. And so the tracing layer will essentially inject field value pairs per span, enter and exit, which is really nice because then you can see inside a given future, like if it has a lot of individual sub-futures that go forever that can result in a long poll, you can see all the span entering and exiting. It does have somewhat high overhead. Tracing in general is not the cheapest, so you don't want to instrument every possible future. We're still figuring out a better model for really low overhead custom event emissions. Probably that will look, at least in the short term, like just a nicer API to dump drone events in. And then we have a really low overhead metrics library called Matrique that we'll probably integrate. But today, yes, you can set up your tracing layer and then, you know, it'll just magically dump all your field value pairs into your online traces.
Okay, very cool. So most of us learned about Dial9, I think, because Carl asked you to make a guest blog on the Tokyo blog, and that was on the 18th of March. I imagine you were developing this tool already like a lot earlier. Like at what point did the development start, and what problem specifically did you have at that point in mind, and also what goals? Maybe give us like a rough timeline from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the ideas for Dial9 started about 2 years ago. Someone said to me, building an AWS service, I wish I could just understand what was happening inside of Tokyo. And at the time, I really didn't have a good answer for them. And it was sort of ruminating. It was also, I was seeing people debug these complex problems with clever tools. Then in February of this year, so what is that, 4 months ago, about 3 months ago, I got a DM from someone who was trying to ramp up traffic to a Rust service at Amazon, and the performance was really weird. Once it got to 90% CPU, the latency went crazy, and they had actually read my previous blog post, some internal Amazon blog post about adding metrics, recorded Tokyo metrics, and the metrics that they had didn't really make any sense. Because it kind of looked like the runtime was just sitting idle, even though it was also very busy. And it became pretty clear we weren't really going to be able to understand and give them a satisfying answer. unless we were actually able to record all of the events in order. So, you know, pull start, pull stop, the worker parked, the worker unparked, and be able to actually look at them afterwards and try to understand kind of what ordering of actual events led to these somewhat very confusing metrics. So that was February. And the first version of Dialline probably only took like a week because it was quite simple. It doesn't have, we'll talk about the Dialline format that it is today. The format back then was much, it was still very compact, but it was much simpler. It wasn't open-ended. It didn't support arbitrary events. It really just supported Tokyo events. So it subscribes to the existing Tokyo runtime books, and we just record events into the trace each time we get one. And what we eventually saw in that case was that this particular application had terrible kernel scheduling delay. So just like Tokyo, the Linux kernel also needs to schedule user space threads on a limited number of CPUs in response to them being ready to run. And in this particular case, because Rust code was competing with a Java process with 16,000 threads, they unsurprisingly had bad. Bad here is relative. This service, P99, is 10 milliseconds. So when you are delayed for 10 milliseconds by kernel scheduling delay, you're immediately in a bad position. And from there, it really started to show that this was going to be a useful tool. And kind of from then to now, it's really been about expanding the scope of the data that comes into it, productionizing it so that it's something that we can really give to people with confidence that they can go run in production, and doing like the work that Jess is doing to start to bring application level events into the trace as well. Because we very quickly saw, you know, I had a friend try this at their company and they sent me a screenshot of their trace file being like, what is happening? I have literally no idea. And it's because if you don't have application events to correlate to the Tokyo events, it's very difficult to see what's going on.
I see. And you mentioned, okay, you started 2 years ago, and also there were these people coming to you with these problems. Now, at that point, there was already this tool called Tokyo Console.
Yes.
It was, I think it's like more of an official Tokyo project, and it is not exactly like Dialline. Actually, it's a very different tool. But still, they hook also into these runtime hooks. They do show you something. Was that ever useful in those kind of cases, or are we talking about actually like a subtly different problem space?
I think it's a little bit of a different problem space. We have seen teams in Amazon try to use Tokyo Console, and there's two main problems. One is that Tokyo Console is really for the problem space of, I'm literally looking at it having a problem right now. Help me figure out what's going on. Especially in the case where you are have handwritten futures and a wake is missing or a deadlock, things like that, it can help to show the pattern. But because it uses the runtime tracing for inside of Tokyo, and for a few other reasons, you really can't run it safely in production. It simply is not designed in a way that it can be run safely in production, at least not inside of AWS. I'm sure people are running it in production elsewhere. And because it doesn't provide an easy way to retroactively look back and be like, okay, this happened, something bad happened. Now let me sit down and really try to digest the exact timeline that led to this problem.
Yeah. It makes me think that the use case of Tokyo Console is actually fairly limited. Like, I mean, it's a very specific problem, while something like Dialline, to me at least, shows a lot more potential. So
I mean,
that's cool.
You know, that's an evolution, yeah. Right? Didn't Tokyo Console come out of our team in the first place? Like, didn't Jack Rand work on that? I mean, that was when people were really learning basics around troubleshooting async systems and just like fundamental mistakes in how they were designing futures. Whereas Dialline is like, in user space, what you have looks right, but things are still going wrong and you need to understand them more deeply. They're just solving a different layer of problem. Tokyo Console is still great as an entry point. Think of it like a REPL style, you know, debugging.
Yeah, correct. But at the same time, if I think back on some war stories where I really was like stuck and I would think, okay, now I really need this kind of tool, rarely did I have the luxury to be able to say, okay, I can exactly reproduce it, or I can exactly look at this is the problem like that. Those almost seem like simple problems, even though I'm sure they're a difficult one in that space. but seems I didn't really encounter them. But yeah, fair point, Jess. That's definitely true as well. So 2 years ago you started, people had issues. The first version took like around a week, you said. You had like a pretty simple thing, but it worked. It already showed value. At that point, what was missing and how did you move forward from there?
Yeah, so from the original version, which just had Tokyo events, I kind of hit the space where I kept trying to add things, and I would add it and it would kind of work, but I knew it wasn't like quite the right fit. And there were also things we just knew it needed. You know, I think the first version would just record files to disk, and the operator had to go retrieve the files, which is obviously it's not scalable. It's very annoying. An operator still has to, in some way, access the host. So basic things like getting the files to S3 we worked on, but the real work happened in splitting out a separate dial line trace format where events would be serialized into that would allow us to have a format that still had the benefits of the old hard-coded format, which is that it's very compact and very efficient to write, but it would also allow us to have open-ended events. So you could at runtime or compile time define custom events in your application and emit those events.
You're skipping a little bit, right? Wasn't the sort of looking inside syscalls one of the first big things we added after the runtime? And that was like where we started to see the limitations of the scheme as we needed to add new event types. It was this game absolutely. Of adding more and more wire.
Yeah, exactly. Once we had the basic format, then I was like, well, it would really be nice if this could also like be a profiling tool. So it's like, well, how hard is it to actually subscribe to Linux performance events? And the answer is like kind of hard, but not that hard. And we're definitely still in the era of, well, it works on this instance type, but if you're on Fargate, you need a different API, and we're continuing to work through those issues. But yeah, exactly. We started adding more and more different types of data into the trace, which started as hard-coded schema stuff, and then eventually we were able to move out into our open-ended format.
Okay. And so what does open-ended mean? Because you mentioned already like a couple of times, but I still cannot really figure out what you really mean with it.
What I mean is that...
Self-describing. That's self-describing. What
it means you can say, I have my own event, the fields are this, and you can create the event, and say dial 9 record event, and we will record that event, and then you will be able to extract it later from your trace file. The original version of dial 9, you know, it had 4 events that it knew about, and you could not add. This was the full set of events. There was no way to add additional events to the format.
Okay. Concretely, there's a header that describes fields and values per event type, and then it's still fairly compact on the wire because individual event records are not containing, you know, the full schema, but there's the header that lets us do schema evolution without updating the format for every new field.
Okay, got you. And so as a user of Dial9, does it feel the same as if I'm adding like tracing events, or is it slightly different?
I would say it is pretty similar. The difference is that in tracing, the way the macro works today is it basically magically will sort of define some compile time constructs when you use the macro. With Dial9 today, you would have to make a struct derive trace event and then emit that at the moment that you wanted it. I suspect we will eventually just make it so that there is a full... We already have span subscriptions. There's no reason why we can't get tracing events into the Dial9 trace as well. And you could literally use tracing, subscribe to Dial9, and you'll just have your tracing events in your Dial9 trace as well.
Okay. And so what I also seem to understand from this history that we are going through is that from very early on, it was clear to you that you want something that hooks into your process, something that's embedded in your process. So it's like a dependency you import, you enable it. And the way you achieve kind of like security is by the fact that nothing can access it because it is just the producer of some kind of files which it uploads to somewhere that it has access to, but the other side doesn't need access in the other direction. It's only like it's producing the files, so it's kind of like a control. And you mentioned S3 because I can imagine that's a natural fit for AWS, but I imagine that you can bring your own export it and do whatever you want, I suppose.
Yeah. That API doesn't literally exist today, but it's...
This week, so...
This week, I think we will add it to be able to add your own export destinations. Exactly.
We might offer some turnkey stuff with, like, Google Cloud, but also just, you know, bring your own I/O destination.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
And
I'd love to see it integrate with OTLP, for what it's worth. I think that'll be a pretty useful, just given the sheer amount of tooling around OTLP, OTEL's wire protocol.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I like OTEL. There's something I don't like about OTEL, but it definitely has great potential, and if you can make use of some of this tooling or protocol, that could be cool. Now, if you use it locally, is it just going to write files to disk, or how does that work?
Yep. You can leave it writing files to disk, and you can go look at those files. For our own internal testing, we just run a local S3, so you could also use that locally, but people have discussed doing some clever collecting locally to live view files, which I think is a good idea. We haven't explored that deeply, but yeah, exactly. Locally, we just push the files to disk, and then you could read them.
Okay, very cool. And it seems that quite quickly you came to somewhere that is very recognizable from the tool list today, or was at that point that we were in the story? If you would see the tool at that point, what would you be missing that you have today?
Yeah, I think very early on, maybe probably about a month in, around, I think I wrote the Tokyo blog post about 1 month after I started coding in earnest on the tool. And I think at that point, all of the major pieces were pretty much fully formed. I think we had the format and S3 was working. There's a lot of nuance around making it actually work well in production that was basically the next 2 months, but the core pieces were there.
Custom events came later. To me, the biggest thing I think that really day one was like Tokyo instrumentation. Day 10 was capturing kernel scheduling delay that was delaying runtime worker threads. I feel like that was the moment where it became sort of net new functionality, right?
Yeah. We're very lucky that the Go ecosystem has built multiple versions of their flight recorder, which is essentially the exact same thing. If we can make ours as good as Go's, that would be great. And that was a lot of inspiration for the design, because I could look at what they did in V1, I could look at what they did in V2, and I could look how they rewrote it and all the mistakes that they made in V1, and basically say, I will not go down that path, I will go down this path instead, and probably it will work well. And the design has definitely been slowly converging more and more to basically be exactly what the Go telemetry recorder does internally.
Okay. And you mentioned already, okay, you hook into kernel event syscalls. A lot of servers in production are running within a Kubernetes cluster and within containers. Do you also gather events from this? Because, like, let's say a cluster or the permissions for I don't know, there are all kind of stuff that influence your app.
Yeah, exactly. It's more limited. We don't have a great story. Running in containerized environments, we can still basically get profiling data, so we can see what your code is doing on the CPU. But unless you have fairly elevated kernel permissions, which I suspect most Kubernetes clusters do not have, you're not going to be able to get the really detailed data. Everything is sort of additive. Like, we can get this data stream and this data stream and this data stream. So at the absolute minimum, we can use the CTimer API to basically get the kernel to send us signals at a particular interval. And when we get those signals, we can walk the stack and basically make you a flame graph. And if it's slightly better than that, the kernel could do the stack walking for us, which is faster and more reliable. And then even more reliable than that, or the next level of events is, we can actually get the kernel to send us a stack exactly when it stops running the work on the CPU. We can talk about that more later, but this turns out to be extremely useful for Tokyo applications specifically, because if your code is polling, if your feature is actually running, and the kernel decides to stop running you on the CPU, that is basically 100% of the time, it is bad. So, you know, something wrong has happened.
See. Okay, very cool. I learned already quite a lot about this tool. Now, today, there is also a dashboard. Is that something that also came quite early, or how were you consuming it in the beginning?
Yeah, the dashboard came really early. This is where modern AI tooling made things possible that wouldn't have been possible a year ago. I think the first version of the dashboard probably took 15 minutes to say, okay, here's the trace file. I want it to look like this. And AI was like, okay, I don't know. And all of a sudden, a pretty crappy, but like functional version of the dashboard.
Day three, I'm like, okay, now make a keyboard accessible. It's pure technical debt. We expect to fully rewrite it, but it's functional.
Yeah, but at least you can start playing with it, and otherwise, who knows how long it might have taken.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, in practice, yeah. It's neat for us debugging, and it's neat for sort of orienting yourself, but we expect the sort of the CLI experience to be more impactful for day-to-day debug, and we expect the viewer to become more of a, like, jump to this spot in the viewer to see something you've discovered out of band. I don't think ultimately it's going to be the primary mode of access. It'll be more for dumb human to keep up with what agent is doing.
Yeah, so that would be my next question is, like, okay, you have all these files. I suspect that if you use like some agents or LLMs, whatever you want to call them, I imagine they will just inspect these and be able to find at least something or give you some clue like where the problem might be.
Yeah, exactly. We took the same algorithms that power the dashboard and we basically put them in a folder, and there's a decent amount of prompting to explain to the agent, like, this is the file format, this is how you parse it.
Your red flags.
This is how Tokyo works, this is how the Tokyo events are persisted, here's some common problems. And yeah, it works really well to be able to ask an agent to go analyze, and you can also start to do things that are very bespoke that I think would be hard to do in any other mode, to ask questions like, oh, for this specific event, for events where it's greater than the P99, what exactly was running on the CPU during these events that were greater on the, that was in these anomalous cases, and diff that against the CPU in the general case, et cetera, et cetera. They're very clever analyses that I think would be really hard to run without, especially the ability to run arbitrary code against the trace files.
Very cool. And do you offer some kind of, I wouldn't say prompts, but like some kind of commands that you can say, like, okay, if you run this command, you get this kind of manual for like an LLM. That's how the format looks like, and that's how you look at it.
Yeah, there's a exactly. Binary crate with both the viewer and a toolkit, and then the toolkit can be used by a human. It has prompts for agents. It's got helper functions. It's all currently JavaScript. We find that's been nice for iterating and tweaking, and it's convenient to be able to share the same utilities from the viewer to the CLI. But yeah, you can generally point your buddy at it, and it'll, tell it to call the cargo Dao9 viewer agent or something like that.
Exactly.
Very cool. Is it also part of the repo, or is it like some separate repository?
Yep. It's in tree, and it's published as a standalone like crate you can install or binstall. So you can find it in the README.
Okay, very cool. And so, okay, so we learned a bit about the history, we learned a bit about you, we learned a bit about how we got here. Now, as it's been in development, you say close to 2 years.
Maybe the idea was
people solving these problems with a collection of tools.
Okay, now I get it. Okay. And then you said...
But it's been, few months, right? That's all for the...
Because you mentioned that you only started like a month before you wrote the blog post.
I think Russell gave a little bit of background, but basically we've seen people solve these sorts of problems by hand, and it came up again, and we said, we're not going to have another expert parachute in and solve these problems by hand. Let's build something that's self-serve. So it was a good motivating factor to figure out how to abstract this stuff into tooling.
Okay. Actually, that is pretty interesting, though. Maybe we can, because I think there's a lot we can learn from this. Can you maybe think of one interesting example that is relatively small in scope, but still, how did this person solve it by, as you mentioned, by hand? Because in the end, okay, there are tools, there are the Tokyo hooks, where they're like all manually probing these. And can you tell a bit about that process?
Tokyo to toss things in. They were doing a lot of out-of-band joining of like kernel-side stuff with Tokyo, with just like scripts, layers and layers of Python scripts and visualization tools. What else, Russell? What are they doing?
Yeah, I know, for example, someone was running into Tokyo scheduling delays. What they ended up doing was they loaded up eBPF probes against Tokyo to try to see exactly when Tokyo was running certain methods, and then they ran the service under a load test. Obviously, this is not in prod. And from this, they were able to see, oh, yes, kernel scheduling delay was preventing Tokyo from waking up the next worker when one worker was unable to keep up with the load, but the second worker, because of kernel scheduling delay, didn't wake up for another 20 milliseconds or whatever, and then that's what ended up causing the scheduling delay. Another story that was inspirational for this is that, similar kernel scheduling story, their P99 was bad, and they couldn't really figure out why, and then they ran their program, I think locally, or either that or in a pre-prod environment, with perfsched, which records way more data than DAO9 records. It records every single context switch in the kernel. And from there, what they realized is that when the Tokyo worker was delayed to wake up, it was always because of tracing appender. So they moved tracing appender to its own thread. They pinned their Tokyo runtime to a separate set of cores, and then their P99 got way better.
Well, so a lesson for all listeners is use tracing appender, put it on its own thread.
Well, it's always on its own thread, well, on its own core.
Yeah. Look at that. And you were mentioning what you said there, like how did they, because you got more information than Dial 9 provides, what they were using specifically?
Yeah, there's a command called perf, S-C-H-E-D, which when you run that, will cause the kernel, or perf will record every single context switch. So anytime that an operating system level thread is run or descheduled by the kernel, and from there you can create this timeline of all your CPUs and all of your threads and see what is actually active at any given time to understand the causes of these problems.
But I mean, that must be a massive amount of information.
Yes, it's a crazy amount of data. I have ideas for how we can get that much information into Dial 9, but I haven't solved the problem yet. So
that's going to need tail sampling or something.
Well, we'll have to do something clever to be able to do that usefully in Dial 9. But this is an example of a story that, you know, watching someone do something very clever that normal people, I think, would really struggle to figure out how to accomplish.
And how do they do that? Like, how do they make sense of all this data? Like, are there some techniques they use for that? I mean,
yeah, there's a command called perfsched time hist that basically lets you like scroll through the events, and it's not. I tried it at one point. It's not easy, but it is possible because there's a very small number of threads you actually care about, namely the Tokyo runtime workers. So it allows you to reduce the crazy amount of events to a much smaller amount of events, where the thread that comes onto the CPU is a Tokyo runtime worker, and you can further filter by times when it was delayed, or if you know this very specific instant when you had a high P99, you can go focus at that instant. But yeah, very, very detailed techniques that require a lot of understanding of internals to use.
And more data to identify problems than you really need. They're so noisy compared to being able to instrument the right parts to start with.
Okay. And so you've been at this now a couple of months where you iterate on the tool. Was there something missing in Tokyo that you, for example, had to contribute to Tokyo itself to make it work? And can you give some examples of that?
Yeah, largely all of the hooks are there. We want to be able to add task dumps. So that means when your task goes idle, being able to capture a stack trace of the actual future itself when it goes idle, because this allows you to see what was actually happening when your code was not running. If you look at a Dial 9 trace, one thing that is very surprising when you first look at it is a tiny amount of the time is actually your code running. Most of the time it is waiting for something. And task dumps would let us see that. We still have not actually landed task dumps in Dial 9 because the feature that I landed in Tokyo to make it possible to take user space task dumps is quite new, and so it requires the latest version of Tokyo, but I think we'll probably try to land task dumps.
And explain why we needed to land user space task dumps. It's a fun Dial 9 story.
Yeah, so the first time that we tried to add task dumps, which was quite early in the development, I added them, because Tokyo does have an API to capture a task dump, but immediately the performance of the application that I was testing was terrible. Like it, the overhead went from like 3% to 100% overhead. And in the downline trace, I could see why, which is that it turns out calling backtrace trace actually has a global lock, which is bad, obviously. There are good reasons why it exists. Namely, it's because of the race between symbolization and unwinding. So to avoid having to deal with that race, they simply have a global lock on everything. But every time we took a task dump, it would try to acquire this global lock. And of course, it's a heavily contended mutex. Your thread gets descheduled and your whole application performance gets quite bad. So our upstream, which we eventually will work to build, to fully extract task dumps from Tokyo itself and basically make them a library, makes it possible for Downline to have its own unwinder. Because Downline already has the machinery to do frame pointer unwinding. It already has the machinery to do symbolization. So we don't actually need the full complexity of what the backtrace crate is doing. We can do a much more efficient stack unwind when we do a task dump, which should make it possible to, not 100% of the time, but close to 100% of the time for most applications, take a task dump every single time your feature goes idle.
That's also inexpensive to me too, but I guess maybe it's less than my intuition says.
It's not free, but it's also many applications spend very little of their time on CPU. Most of the time, they're actually just waiting for I/O. So taking a task dump, which takes, let's say it takes 200 nanoseconds.
Not the same as the tracing layer.
Before you go idle, and then you're going to wait 5 milliseconds for some networking request, it doesn't end up being a complete blocker for your application.
Okay. And so, as you said, Downline, you can kind of think of it as layers of sources of information. Tokyo being one of them, does that mean that Downline would still be useful to people that don't use Tokyo?
Today, not exactly, but probably in the next few weeks, we will fully separate out the Downline core, which has nothing to do with Tokyo, and then the Tokyo instrumentation is just you could think of it a plugin or a layer feeding data into Downline. Yeah. So already, I suspect we'll have internal customers at Amazon that don't actually want the Tokyo stuff. At least they don't want it all the time. They really just want profiling data, and they're just using Downline as basically a bus to pull in profiling data from the Linux kernel and get it to S3.
And enrich it with custom events.
And enrich it with their custom events. So, yeah, exactly. The Downline started for Tokyo, and it is still a little, there's still some tendrils in there, but I'm working on extracting all of the tendrils to make it so that Tokyo is not special in terms of how it interacts with Downline.
Very cool. And then, of course, given it's mostly focused on these kind of hard problem spaces that often happen in, like, production infrastructure. We usually think about Linux, but some people run on Windows. Is that something that is currently supported or is, like, out of scope? Or I don't know, what's the story there?
Yeah. The only things that are Linux-specific in Downline today is these Linux operating system events. Presumably, there is a Windows equivalent of it. And presumably, somebody, if sufficiently motivated, could basically write a Windows stack trace sampler for Downline, and those things would flow in just fine. Everything else is not operating system specific.
And let's say someone has their own source of information and they would like to somehow tie it in. It's not like an event because it's not in their like process, but it's like from some other source, like somehow they got information. Can they easily hook it into the system, or like what's the story there?
The best way, if it's not, you know, for example, if they have external logs or something, is to have something like a request ID in their logs and then emit an event in Downline that has the same request ID, which will then allow them to correlate between the Downline events and their external events. This is somewhere where being able to analyze these things with code, I think, is really powerful, because you can write some code that first look at these logs and find request IDs that are bad in some way, and then go to Downline and filter out the Downline. You know the timestamp, so you find the right Downline file, and then you search that Downline file for the request ID. And then because the request ID is probably only running on one Tokyo task normally, you can then recreate the entire lifecycle of that request ID in your Downline trace and figure out, aha, the problem was this. You know, it got stuck behind this task that had a very long pull, and that's why this request ID was slow, for example.
Mm. Yeah, that show the power of just operating on raw files, which I guess it's a huge flexibility that you do miss if you want to just have some kind of visual interface or something. And I guess that's also why you were kind of saying that, okay, it's nice to have this dashboard and it's nice to see it, but it's definitely not going to be the main interface to really solve the difficult issues, because, yeah, most of the time you will probably need a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, or you need to aggregate bigger.
There's probably a story here about wrapping into your honeycomb and, you know, having the right visualizations to be wrapping timeline in. It's a larger problem. We're focused on getting sort of the internals and the CLI because it's a simpler problem. But in the fullness of time, I imagine you will be able to have visualization that ties into your other visualization. Like, clearly, you know, the writing on the wall here is that you want to drill into these things. We just, you know, one problem at a time.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And the community can, of course, also help with this. Like, maybe some people are more, like, visually inclined than others, and they might have ideas, like, how to, I don't know, do that. Okay, very cool. So you already mentioned that you were working on this task stack unwinding, and that's like a feature that's recently added to Tokyo. Are there some other features that you would like to see added or stabilized in Tokyo, and that would meaningfully improve your capabilities?
Yeah, the biggest one, and there's no easy way to do this. I was lucky enough to chat with Alice at length about this at TokyoCon. To get the most value out of DAO 9, you really need to be running our future. So our future wraps your future, because that allows us to instrument the waker so that we know exactly when the actual wake event happened, so that we can measure scheduling delay. And it allows us to capture a task dump for you. And, well, those are really the two main things, but they're two main things that I think are quite important. The last thing, which is that right now the pull start, pull stop callbacks, because they use Dyn dispatch on like a box Dyn FN for applications that have a very large number of pulls, it's actually simply having those callbacks is a performance, it creates a lot of performance overhead that we wouldn't have if you basically ended up statically compiling your future inside of our future. So figuring out a way to have Tokyo always wrap the caller provided future in a given generic future is kind of the holy grail, I think, for this sort of observability. And there are a lot of clever ideas that would make this tractable, but they're not very rusty, if you know what I mean. You know, for example, internally in Amazon, where we have the luxury of being able to unilaterally patch all crates, we can simply patch Tokyo to wrap your future in this, you know, magic DAO 9 future, for example, but that does not work externally. There are crazy proc macro approaches where you late expand it, but I suspect eventually someone will come up with a very clever idea to solve this problem, because it's something that is generally needed for a lot of different use cases where you're trying to understand exactly what's happening with your tasks and with your futures.
Yeah, I mean, in some language like Python, I guess you would just monkey patch it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I guess you wish you could do that here. And how I would do those things in C or C++ is I would like just provide my own definitions against the same kind of header files, but of course, that's also not possible here. Yeah, and Rust is pretty tricky. I will be very curious to see what you come up with, because one thing you could say, okay, when you register the future in your runtime, at that point you could of course wrap it, but not all futures get registered, because it's only for the outer future, right? Which is the task.
And we only need to wrap the outer future, to be clear. We really just need to wrap the call to Tokyo spawn, so that Tokyo spawn, at that moment, it's wrapping it in some sort of downline future.
That does make it more doable, I guess. I mean, should be possible somehow, no, to let your runtime somehow provide some kind of optional callback or something, I don't know.
The problem you run into is that it is possible, but by the time you resolve all of the generics, you're like three boxes deep inside the future, which would technically work, but I suspect we'd kind of defeat the performance point.
Yeah, because of course you mentioned that somewhere, I forgot where it was mentioned, but I seem to recall that you wrote somewhere, maybe it's in your blog post, I don't know where, but where it said you want Dial 9 to be something that people can just enable in any production system and they don't have to worry about it. Like, it shouldn't be something that they explicitly enable. They just should configure it once and then it just lives there. But for that, of course, yeah, given how performant the systems you are dealing with, I mean, that's a high bar, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, very cool, very exciting. So now these people do have this tool. Yeah, especially those kind of people, the ones who actually are very good, like they have the tools and they could do it the hard way. Do they now also grab to Dial 9 and find ways to use it?
Yeah, I think Dial 9 has allowed people to actually, instead of having to simulate production, they can just look at it in production. For example, this is not a happy story, or not a successful story, but for the original customer, the one with 16,000 operating system threads, and for they're also trying to run Rust at the same time, tried making the nice level on Rust much lower so that the kernel would prioritize it. And unfortunately, Dial 9 showed that it did not help, which is not too surprising because of the way that the clock works inside of the kernel. But these sorts of things previously would be difficult even to validate. Now they can see, like, yep, we changed the niceness level, and it did not help the kernel scheduling delay at all. It's still fairly early days with other services at Amazon, so I don't have a ton of real production stories yet, but we're getting much closer to seeing people start to solve problems in production with them.
Yeah, and I guess given how you also hook into all the other things, I suspect that Dial 9 can be a tool in general, Amazon, even for non-Rust teams, I suppose.
Yeah, you could imagine that you build Python bindings to the, like, emission APIs or something and start emitting events that way. Yeah, exactly.
Is that something that you're planning or just a wild idea?
Wild idea. This path has crossed my mind, but it's definitely not that high on my, on the next set of things that I'm going to try.
I would expect that to probably come from a team that is using Rust and Python and has this use case, and then, you know, we'll start shimming it in and we'll help them facilitate contributing that upstream and so forth.
Yeah, for sure. And so you mentioned, okay, only because now we are in this moment where LLMs can help us with these kind of things that we're not ourselves maybe good at, or maybe we have no time for. And one example was the dashboard. What else would be missing in Dial 9 that now you actually can develop?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say there's a few things. Even the ability to analyze the trace files is something that absolutely people can write the code to do. No question. This is not complicated code, but this is exactly the kind of code that I would sit down and it would take me an hour to look at the docs for the trace file and assemble a stack trace and deduplicate the stack trace and whatever. But an LLM is so good at it. It's very small. It's very scoped. They're not trying to refactor some complicated project. They're literally trying to solve an interview question, basically, to analyze this trace file. And it's so powerful. At least the other thing as well, especially at the beginning, it did allow me to write, once I had the idea in mind for exactly what shape I wanted it to, the backend, the core to be, it was able to really accelerate the process, especially in things like, I want an integration test that spins up a local S3, runs a Dial 9 trace, uploads all the files to local S3, downloads all the files from local S3, validates that every single event is there. You know, of course, yes, I could write that test. It would take me 20 minutes, or, you know, an LLM could write the test and it takes 20 seconds. I think because we had so much prior art that made it less of, like, not so much wandering in the design space, that it was useful just to even write the back end as well.
Okay. And then before we look a bit into the horizon, maybe we can formally understand a bit better what a Dial 9 code base exactly is, because we already know, okay, you have your format for how you write these events and this and that. You have some kind of exporter. You have a dashboard. You have this other tool to help you with some, I don't know, docs or manuals or prompts or whatever.
Yeah.
I suppose you have some utilities to make it easier to hook Dial 9 into your code base. Is there some other like critical component I'm missing in the Dial 9 code base that people should like discover or that they might not immediately?
Yeah, so I would say if we sort of start at the bottom, the format is probably the most, has a lot of sort of load-bearing design decisions. The fact that it's self-describing, it's very compact, it's very fast to encode. It also allows us to have nanosecond precision timestamps, which is quite useful for correlation, obviously. And the fact that it's quite easy to parse. One of the places that I think a lot of the other efforts, like JFR, the Java Flight Recorder format, or even the Go format, are extremely complicated to parse and completely undocumented, which makes it really hard to have like an ecosystem of tools around it. From there, there's actually the buffers where all your data goes. So all the data in Dial 9 is going into a thread local buffer, which allows us to obviously record events without any concurrency. So you get the event, we encode it into its final binary format, like right then when we get it into the thread local buffer. And the problem with thread local buffers is, of course, how eventually do you get the data out of the thread local buffer? So the thread local buffers, there's an epoch counter that ticks up, I think, about every 30 seconds, depending on how you have it configured. And basically, when it ticks the next event that the buffer gets, it will actually flush the buffer to the central queue. But because these events are happening relatively rarely, it doesn't create a lot of contention. There's a little bit of other cleverness to also be able to flush buffers even when they aren't producing events, but eventually the buffers make it to a central queue where that eventually is going up to disk. And then once it gets to disk, yeah, what Jess was mentioning, so when we any time that we are recording stack traces in Dial 9, we're just recording addresses because that's basically all we have time to do at the moment that we're capturing them. So in the background thread, we look at all the addresses that you have, and we turn those into symbols so that when you look at a flame graph in Dial 9, it's actually useful and understandable. And then from there, that goes to S3 or wherever you have it configured. So that's all, basically all that we just discussed right there is both the core part is in Dial 9 Tokyo Telemetry, the Linux stuff is in a crate called Dial 9 Perf Self Profile, and then the format is in a crate called Dial 9 Trace Format, I think, all in the same GitHub repo. And then the analysis stuff is all in the Dial 9 Viewer crate.
Okay. Yeah, the format, that's Dial 9 Trace Format, I guess. That's your specification, basically, your data format.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what is Dial 9 Macro about?
Yes. So we recently added a new way to onboard to Dial 9 that's much simpler, where you can basically just replace Tokyo main with Dial 9 main, effectively. And we will automatically turn on Dial 9 for you, and you can choose how to configure it by environment variables or however fits your use case. It is not adding a ton of code. It's just some boilerplate that is kind of annoying to add, so it makes it much easier to switch to it.
Okay, right now we have Dial 9. What's coming next for that tool? Like what are some features you are working on that you're most excited near term? And yeah, how do you prioritize, like, what's on the roadmap?
The top thing on the roadmap for me, recently a big AWS services has started using it. So I actually am actually integrating Shuttle, the deterministic simulation testing runtime, into Dial 9 to try to really tease out any weird bugs. So correctness and getting it as stable as possible is my number one priority right now. To be clear, I have no reason to suspect that it is not stable, but I would much rather find these problems before our customers do. Separate from that, task dumps and memory profiling are probably the next two biggest customer-facing features. Jess is working on getting Matrix events. So that's events from our wide event metrics library directly into your Dial 9 traces.
Ideal being path of least resistance should be whatever metadata you already have should go in the trace, and tracing is a fairly expensive way to do that. So Matrix is
much lower overhead. You don't have hash maps and so forth in the picture.
After that, I think we'll probably try to do tail sampling so that by default, Dialine is recording the data, but basically not doing anything with it. And if in your there will be an application level API to basically say something bad has happened, and then Dialine will dump all of the data that it has in its buffer to S3 or whatever your output is. This is because in general application usage, the main overhead is actually just simply the amount of data that Dialine is producing. So being able to constrain how much data you're literally uploading to S3 is kind of the main problem. And beyond that, trying to make the viewer have a better experience, especially when you're trying to use both AI to analyze your traces and use the viewer to analyze your traces and making those fit together better.
That last one sounds like something you can just lose endless amount of time. I bet you will keep finding stuff. Now, given all the information that people have about Dialine, is there something that we didn't talk about yet that they should know?
I think we covered a lot. It would probably be good to talk about the considerations for enabling Dialine in production. That would probably be a useful topic. That's the main one. Do you have anything in mind, Jess?
If you're going to use tracing, don't shove AWS SDK traces. They're very noisy. Be careful about how much you instrument. Probably mentioning using handle spawn is important, so you can capture wake times.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You want to give the rep?
Yeah. So if you are considering enabling Dialine in production, obviously the most important thing is to try it with your app outside of production or in production in a very limited environment before you do so. It does require using Tokio Unstable. Tokio Unstable refers to API instability and not runtime instability. So the main problem here is that consuming a new Tokio version could cause your code to stop compiling. Dialine does increase the memory usage of your application because we have these thread local buffers that we're recording events into. So if you have a huge number of threads, all of which are producing Dialine events, this is not really how most Tokyo-based applications are structured, but it does exist, then Dialine could end up using a lot more memory. Currently, there's a 1 megabyte buffer allocated for each thread, which is not crazy, but if you have 10,000 threads or something, it would probably be a problem. To get the most useful data out of Dialine, you do need to spawn via our spawn wrapper, which allows us to wrap the feature for you. Other than that, I think those are the main considerations.
Okay. Let's say people are convinced that they can use it. Where would you guide them towards? Like, what would be the starting point?
Yeah. The README should actually be a great place to start. There are a few examples that show specifically how to enable it based on runtime configuration. So, for example, checking some environment variable and then based on that environment variable, turning Dialine on or not turning Dialine on. That would be the best place to start. And then once you have a trace file, which you can just push to disk, I would definitely take a look at the trace file and see what you're getting before you ship it, if possible. Because there's a number of small little configuration things like, my proof event setting is not right, so I don't have any flame graphs, or this setting is not right, so symbolization didn't work, et cetera, et cetera. And ironing out those issues locally is much easier than ironing them out in production. But the README is the best place to start.
Okay. Very cool. So with that in mind, I thank you both for your time. Like, it was very insightful. I came into this episode not knowing too much about Dialine because I said to myself, I really need to play with it before this recording. Well, we know how these things go. It didn't happen. I'm still convinced it's a very useful tool and I really do want to start playing with it. I'm very excited for it and all the things you said to me about it and what I learned about it. Some things I upfront had a wrong conception about, but now I'm saying it better. And so I really want to start using it. So I'm very grateful for the both of you to explain us where this tool came from, how you're using it, how maybe people did it before they had Dial 9. I did also already watch your demo, so that demo is definitely something I will link in the show notes. I'm also very much looking forward to see your lightning talk from TokyoConf, as the first ever Tokyo conference happened less than 2 weeks, but definitely more than a week, I think. So that's very cool. So thank you, both of you, and I wish you a lot of luck with the continued development of Dial 9 and all the other exciting stuff that you both end up doing at Amazon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Let us know what you think. PRs are very welcome.
Netstat.fm is brought to you by Rama, an open source framework for moving and transforming network packets. Rama is built and maintained by Plavio, a company focused on secure, open, and resilient infrastructure with Rust protocols and purpose. The theme music of this podcast was composed by DJ Mailbox. For more conversations like this, subscribe so you don't miss what's coming next. And if you know someone who could benefit from this episode, share it with them. They might appreciate it. Have experience in protocols, networking, or infrastructure, and want to share your work, your ideas, or experience? We would love to hear from you. Reach out at hello@netstat.fm. Thank you for being here. See you next time for the next handshake.